I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. May 8, 1945 is a date to remember. For much of the Western world, it marked the end of the greatest conflict ever seen. Today, a look back on the Allied forces' victory in World War II. From the crumbling German front in Berlin to the jubilant celebration in Times Square, we tour through the ages and places leading up to VE Day. Then learn about America's great unbanking. We'll find out why more and more Americans are turning to check cashing companies for financial services that used to be the bread and butter of traditional banks and what it says about our economy. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Rick Eckinson's trilogy of World War II stands as one of the monumental works of reporting and writing about war. His Liberation trilogy is comprised of An Army at Dawn, that followed the war in North Africa, Volume 2, The Day of Battle, described the war in Sicily and Italy, where Bob Dole famously suffered his wounds. The final volume, The Guns at Last Light, starts at D-Day in June 1944 and ends with the formal German surrender 11 months later. Rick is a former writer and senior editor at the Washington Post. He won a Pulitzer at the Kansas City Times for his stories on the West Point class of 1966. We are just 3 days away from Monday's VE Day, or Victory in Europe Day, so we thought it would be a good time to visit with Rick Eckinson one more time. And Rick, always a pleasure. Thanks for taking some time.
Thanks, Steve. It's always good to be with you.
You know, I'm wondering about your own thoughts, Rick, about war, you know, and how World War II followed the First World War so closely, how Korea followed the Second World War within just a few years, and all the fighting we've had since those wars. You know, is there a need to fight that is somehow just wrapped into our DNA?
Well, it's hard to argue otherwise, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You figure that the number of years in recorded history in which there has not been a war in progress somewhere is simply a couple hundred, and that's out of several thousand years of recorded history. You have to believe that there is some impulse, some part of us, whether it's in our DNA or otherwise, that simply makes us a bellicose species.
I know your book set out to rectify this, but there's still something about Americans that seems to stop us from fully acknowledging just how brutal this war was, or any war for that matter. Why is that? I mean, what stops us from a full embrace of all this? Or is the reality just too brutal to embrace?
Well, I think if you talk about World War II, you have difficulty understanding, even if you went through it, precisely how horrific it was. We're talking about 60 million dead over the course of 6 years from 1939 to 1945. That's a death every 3 seconds for 6 years. And that is something that most people have difficulty, I think, imagining, the brutality of it, and the fact that of those 60 million, many of them were horrible deaths, deaths that befell frequently young men dying prematurely. And so, you know, I think we tend to avert our eyes. I don't know that that's necessarily a flaw in human character not to want to contemplate something that's so awful. But I think to fully understand what the consequences are of any war, and particularly a big bad war like the Second World War, it's necessary to face it full on and to understand what we did to ourselves.
You know, along those lines, Rick, you tell the story in Guns at Last Light about a man named Henry Wright, who was a widower and was waiting at the train station when the bodies of his three sons came home from World War II. Describe him to us.
Well, he was a widower. He lived down near Springfield, and he was part of that awful legacy of the war, a father who's outlived his sons. In his case, he outlived three sons. those who lost loved ones during the war, and we had about 291,000 Americans killed in action, about 400,000 dead altogether from disease and accidents and so on. Those who had lost loved ones overseas in 1947 were given a one-time opportunity by the U.S. government to have their children, they were usually their sons, repatriated, brought home for permanent burial, or they could leave them overseas in one of more than a dozen American Battle Monuments Commission cemeteries. About 60% of them chose to have their boys brought home, and Henry Wright was among them. And he had a son who had been killed. All three of them were killed in Europe. One of them died in a German prison camp, having been wounded. One of them died during the Battle of the Bulge, and one of them died in April 1945, just a couple weeks before VE Day, the end of the war in Europe. And there's a very poignant scene of those boys arriving home, having been repatriated, come home on a ship. The ship would berth in New York, the coffins would be unloaded, and travel by train, in this case, to southwest Missouri. And Henry and his neighbors were waiting for them, and the coffins were carried into the house and placed in the bedroom where each of those boys had been born. And the neighbors kept vigil overnight. They sprinkled rose petals on the floor of the house, and then the next morning they carried them to Hilltop Cemetery for burial side by side by side. And I think it's difficult for any of us to imagine the pain of that particular day and the pain of Henry Wright. But it's important on VE Day and every day, frankly, to remember what the Wright family and many other families like his gave.
We'll never see world wars like we've seen before ever again. Do I have that right, Rick?
Oh, I never say never if you're a historian. I think that we're unlikely to see anything that's quite as sweeping. If there were a war that involved, as World War II did, scores of nations. By the end of the war, we had 60 allied nations fighting with us. If that were to happen again over the course of 6 years, you have to think that it would become a nuclear war at some point. And that is horrific beyond anybody's imagination. You know, the thing about World War II that I think makes it unique and probably not something that's going to be replicated in history or repeated precisely is simply the fact that you had so many countries that got involved to one degree or another, so many people fighting, so many deaths, the magnitude of it, the duration of it, the violence of it, all were unique. Even World War I did not reach those depths. And so we can only hope that we'll never see it again.
I'm visiting with historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson about his three books on World War II. Did you set out to write three books, Rick, or did that evolve as you got into this thing?
No, Steve, when I started, I had three in mind. I had kind of analyzed how the story ought to be told, because it is a story. It's the greatest story of the 20th century. And it broke into three parts. The liberation of Europe really begins in North Africa in 1942 when we and the British invade Algeria and Morocco. And then the second act of this great drama picks up in the summer of 1943 with the invasion of Sicily and subsequently the invasion of mainland Italy. And then the third and final and in some ways most dramatic of the acts begins at Normandy in June of 1944. So I saw it as a three-part saga right from the beginning.
I read in one of your interviews that as you got into this thing more than once, maybe you wondered what you had gotten yourself into here.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I don't think I realized that it was going to be a 15-year project. I started really in earnest in January 1999, and the third and final volume was published in the spring of 2013. I thought I knew something about World War II, but the depth of my ignorance was something that I came to realize as I was doing the research. And the extraordinary opportunity for an archive rat, as I am, to really get into the bowels of archives all around the country and all around the world, really, and find things that had not been found before and to tell stories that had not been told is something that I don't think I appreciated when I started out on this.
What were you ignorant about as you launched into this thing?
Well, in retrospect, I think I was ignorant about a lot of it, including my own ignorance, which is the worst kind of ignorance. There were things that I simply didn't know. One small thing that really struck me over and over again was the degree of Anglophobia in the U.S. Military ranks, particularly among Army generals, with the exception, the notable exception, of Dwight Eisenhower.
Anglophobia meaning what, Rick?
Anglophobia meaning disdain for the British, real dislike.
Our allies, yeah.
Approaching, yes, our closest allies. With the notable exception of Eisenhower, almost to a man, those senior generals, including Omar Bradley from Missouri and George Patton and Mark Clark, who was the senior commander in Italy, they really disliked the British. Now, that is a challenge when they're your closest ally, and the depth of animosity got deeper as the war went on. That's partly because these are 19th century men. George Patton, born in 1885, for example, Eisenhower, born in 1890, and they have been raised to think of the British as our hereditary enemy, the foe that tried to keep us from getting our independence, the enemy that subsequently burned the Capitol in Washington, where I am now. And so that's really imprinted in them. And then they've had, in some cases, unsavory experiences in World War One. And it must be said that the British can be supercilious. They can really be obnoxious and overbearing. And so discovering that cultural wrinkle to me was something that was not only surprising, but it helps to account for some of the difficulties that Eisenhower has in trying to keep this fractious coalition, which he commands, together. So there are many, many surprises like that that I found as I went through this over the course of years.
You know, Eisenhower obviously is one of our guys from out here in Kansas, and I'm wondering, how does he rate in hindsight now, as you have had this chance to examine so closely his actions during World War II as the Supreme Allied Commander? How does he rate in your mind?
Well, I've lived with him for 15 years, and you got to know him quite well as a general and as a man. As a tactician, he's not particularly good. He has never heard a shot fired in anger when he is the theater commander in the Mediterranean for the invasion of North Africa, and then for Italy, and then for Western Europe. And there are many things that he doesn't know. He missed World War One. He's just not a natural battle captain, but that's not really his job. His job is to be the supreme Allied commander of, as I said, this fractious coalition, which eventually has 60 members, and to hold together against the centrifugal forces that pull at every coalition in every war. And he's brilliant at that. He's really good at it. And part one of the reasons is he can get along with the British. He recognizes that it's absolutely critical to the success of the Allied effort in the war, and that it's critical to America's fortunes in the war. So, I think I come away seeing him as someone who grows in the job, a man of great probity, great honesty. He's considered to be the very incarnation of sincerity. He's a natural leader. He's a natural politician. It's the main reason that Franklin Roosevelt chooses him to be the Supreme Commander. He says he's the best politician among the generals. And Eisenhower doesn't see that as a slur. He knows that politics is an important part of any great enterprise, including war.
You know, I'm wondering how you began to wrap your arms around the enormity of a task that you undertook here. Because, Rick, you've said that U.S. Army records alone for World War II weigh, and get this, folks, 17,000 tons. And that's absolutely breathtaking. So how did you proceed with that in front of you?
Well, you have to be judicious, obviously, about what you're going to spend your time researching, and no one has or ever will go through all 17,000 tons. So, you know, I'm trying to keep my eye on the donut, not on the hole. I recognize that I am telling a story that is the greatest story of the 20th century, and that it's important to, as a storyteller, find the little brushstrokes of detail that help bring a character or an episode, an incident to life, while at the same time not getting sidetracked by ancillary material that simply doesn't add to the larger story. You know, I probably spent time in 20 or 25 different archives, some of them for cumulatively months at a time, like the National Archives here in Washington, and some very small and somewhat obscure archives, and some in between, like the Eisenhower Library in Abilene. I try to go in with an idea of what I'm looking for. Sometimes you don't know what you're looking for, and you have serendipity, a happy discovery that you didn't know was there. But frequently I will at least have a plan. I'm looking for information about this or about that person. And you know, recognizing that it's finite, that you can wander into the woods and never wander out when you take on a big topic like this, that there are deadlines to meet, and you just muddle through as well as you can, and you have to be comfortable, I think, with ambiguity and uncertainty. There are things that I don't know that I will never know, and they're there for some scholar in the future to find, because great events, like great personalities, are bottomless. There's always more to write about.
You know, critics have talked about your Liberation Trilogy as being so full of these incredible details, the smells and sights and sounds of war, and even details like this from An Army at Dawn, your first book, where you describe a barber chair in Algiers with a label on it that said, "Made in St. Louis." First, can you talk about how you discover facts like that and how you decide what made it into your sprawling account of this war?
Well, the little factoids, those little brushstrokes of detail, are things that can come up in finding memoirs, letters that soldiers write home. They're not allowed to write about issues that have to do with security or troop movements, that sort of thing. So they frequently end up writing about daily life, things that won't get censored. And that can be very valuable to a writer 70 years later. You know, I spend a lot of time looking at pretty mundane stuff like shipping orders and quartermaster reports. And in a quartermaster report, if three barber chairs have been ordered to be sent to Eisenhower's headquarters in Algiers, it might tell you where they're from. I don't remember specifically that one. And then in terms of deciding what you're going to include, you know, I think the author has got to have an ear for detail, and when it adds to the story, when it adds to the reader's imagination, because it's the reader's imagination that a nonfiction writer is relying on. I can't make it up, but I can provoke your imagination to come up with images, and you can see this scene unfolding in front of you if I've done it properly. And finding details that help you as a reader to do that is part of the narrative art.
Now, one of our listeners told us that out of all three of your books, 1,800 pages worth, that she counted only seven named women who were neither wives nor daughters, mothers, or lovers. Those same seven women were chiefly reporters and nurses, with the exception of the infamous Axis Sally. Your focus of the trilogy was on the combat, which by default excluded women as commanders and fighters, but she wanted to know more about how women impacted the war by working within the military, whether on the Axis or on the Allied side.
Yeah, that's a fair criticism. I'm a military historian. I write about war, and particularly wars of the past, not today, I might add, but wars of the past, they tend to be all male or nearly all male affairs. And it's difficult to find a way to work women into that story. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't have a meaningful role as nurses, in some cases here in the U.S., as pilots, certainly in factories. Were I writing more explicitly about the arsenal of democracy and all the factories that produce all of the munitions and jeeps and planes and so on, then you have 19 million women who are working outside the home for the first time in World War II, and they're incredibly important to the success that we have in the war. But I'm not. I'm writing about battlefields and about battle headquarters and so on. And there you don't find very many women. So, it's something that I was aware of from the beginning. It's something that I pondered and tried to wrestle with. And the truth is, if I want to tell that story, then it's a different story than the one that I set out to write about. So there are fine accounts and books and some really great memoirs from women who served in one capacity or another. But they tend to be on the fringe of the story that I'm writing about.
Now, what were some reactions from readers, Rick, that surprised you or made you think differently about the three books you put out here?
Oh, I think, Steve, the thing that has struck me the most, and I've had thousands of letters and emails and responses of one sort or another, has been the depth of feeling that the succeeding generations have. My father is 92. He went into the Army in 1943. He was a career infantry officer, so I grew up in the Army. He knows what he did. He knows what the war was and the subsequent wars he was in. But it's the children, the grandchildren, now the great-grandchildren, who may not know very much about it, either because their soldier is long gone, or because they don't want to talk about it, or because their memories have failed. And so it's really the extent to which they have felt an emotional tie to that story that I'm telling, and the extent to which it first reveals something about their family. Even if I haven't named them specifically, it's something about their story. It's part of their DNA, really, part of our collective DNA. And so I think that hearing the reactions from them, college kids now, who obviously were born generations after the war ended at this point, and yet feeling what I hope that they would feel, that this was one of the most critical, most awful events in human history. And for them to come away with that really makes me feel pretty good about what it is that I've done.
Rick, just finally today, how should our listeners out there remember VE Day, and why is it still important to keep doing this, and what can people do?
Well, you know, it's one of the most significant dates in our national history. It's not the end of the war, because the war in the Pacific is still going on for several more months, but it's the defeat of fascism in Europe. It's the crushing of Hitler and the Third Reich. It's the end of our own sacrifices in Europe, and it's the beginning of something else. It's the beginning of rebuilding Europe and a post-war challenge that's enormous and is still going on to this day. So it ought to be remembered as one of those signal points when we think about our history and how we got to where we are today. What can they do about it? You know, I think just a moment's reflection, whether it's in thinking about the grandfather you had who served in one capacity or another, or the grandmother you had that worked in an airplane plant or that ammunition plant in Johnson County, or just thinking about the magnitude of what happened, the extraordinary national unity required to get there. We can do this. We have done it before. We can show by remembering the successes that we had in World War II precisely what it means to be an American in all the glory of that species. And I think that's one of the things that VE Day ought to signify for all of us.
Rick Atkinson is the author of the Liberation Trilogy, An Army at Dawn, The Day of Battle, and The Guns at Last Light. And Rick, always great to have you here. Thanks for a good conversation.
Thanks, Steve. Good to talk with you.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the unbanking of America and how banks are abandoning the middle class. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we got some tips on late spring gardening and spoke with a computer hacker turned FBI consultant about the art of digital invisibility. Find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. On Monday, Dr. Wes Crenshaw is back to share how media can open important conversation points with your team. Well, banks have abandoned the middle class, and they've abandoned the poorest among us. That's according to author Lisa Servan, who says that so many struggling Americans these days are forced to rely on alternatives, such as prepaid debit cards, payday lenders, and check cashing centers. Traditional banks, she says, no longer meet the needs of working folks. Instead, banks hit them up with all manner of unexpected fees. Here's a stat for you. Just a few years ago, Americans paid $38 million in overdraft fees. Lisa Servan took jobs at a check cashing center and a payday lender to get a look into the world of the unbanked. She's a professor of city planning at the University of Pennsylvania. She's written on consumer financial services for the Wall Street Journal and is the author of several books, including her latest, The Unbanking of America. And Lisa, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Banks, you say, have given up on the middle class. They've given up on the poor. And I'm wondering why. You know, isn't there money to be made there?
Well, it's a combination of things, really. You know, as banks have gotten bigger and consolidated, and as regulation has allowed them to both do investment banking and commercial banking, the kind of banking that serves all of us, they have started making money in other ways, and they're more interested in serving people who already have a lot of money. They don't make as much money off of lower income people, and so many find themselves kind of not able to use banks, even though they'd like to.
So in this evolution you're talking about when it comes to our banks, you're saying that they're now less focused on the needs of consumers. But again, I thought that's what banks did.
That's right. And so there are really two things that happened. One is a policy changes. So right after the Depression, we passed a law called Glass-Steagall, which many listeners may have heard about, that said, hey, you guys, banks, you can't take such huge risks with people's money. We saw where that led us. And so they really made banks separate and not be able to engage in investment banking and to take these kinds of risks. In that long period of 70 years between the 30s and 1999, when we passed another law called Gramm-Leach-Bliley, was known as the 363 era of banking, which is kind of a joke. You know, the idea was that you'd get 3% interest on your savings account, you would pay 6% interest on a loan, and the banker could go to the golf course by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Then we passed Gramm-Leach-Bliley in 99, and banks are once again able to do that investment banking, and that enables them to change their business model. The other thing that happens during that period, kind of toward the end of that period, is the banks discover fees. They used to make a lot of their money off of that interest income. And in the 80s and 90s, they start realizing that they can start charging people fees. And as you mentioned in your intro, those fees have become a real issue for lots and lots of people and have kept people from being able to afford banks.
And so in the meantime, check cashing businesses, payday lenders, they begin to fill the gap. Why do people trust them? Because they're supposed to be predatory and sleazy. At least that's what you hear all the time. So why would people be willing to pay that, you know, those scary high costs associated with those businesses?
That's a really good question. And that's what I thought, too. I thought I kind of believed everything that I had read. But then I saw how big those businesses were growing. The payday lending industry, for example, grew from a $10 billion to a $30 billion industry between 2000 and 2010. And I thought to myself, you know, the implication when we talk about people using them is that people might not be making the right decisions. And having done research in poor communities for 20 years, I thought, you know, I know a lot of low-income people. I've talked to them, and they absolutely know where their money is going. So there's got to be more to the story than that. I actually took a job working as a teller in the South Bronx at a check casher and as a teller and loan collector in Oakland, California at a payday lender. And what people told me was surprising. They said that for them, using payday lenders sometimes and check cashers it was less costly than a bank, that these businesses were more transparent, and they also felt like they were better served. And I was surprised by that because it goes exactly against the conventional wisdom.
That's interesting. You point out that about the same time, the financial situations of so many Americans, you know, became more precarious due to declining wages and increasing costs for health care and the like. How did this play into the hands of payday lenders and check cashing businesses?
It's a huge aspect of this that's really important. So I think when we think of these alternative financial services businesses, we often do think that they're only frequented by low-income people. And what I found in my research is that, for example, the fastest growing group of people who are using payday lenders owns their home, they have college educations, they make incomes of $50,000 to $75,000 a year. And so what we see happening is, yes, wages have declined steadily since the 1970s. A lot more people are working part-time work or hourly work instead of salary jobs that come with good benefits. Income volatility has doubled over the last 30 years, which means that people are much less able to predict from week to week or month to month how much money is coming into the household. And if that volatility, for example, if you get hit with an unexpected expense like a medical bill or a car repair, when your income is dipping because you didn't get as many hours at your hourly job, suddenly you don't have a buffer to pay for that. And you are thrust into a situation where you often might need to get a payday loan. 75% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and more than half could not come up with $500 in the event of an emergency.
God, that's amazing.
And this is a different situation. There are probably people who are your neighbors, who you work with, who are dealing with these situations, but it's largely invisible, the fact that it's so many more people that we used to think of as being have kind of the hallmarks of being middle class.
Lisa Servon is my guest. Her new book, The Unbanking of America. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is the number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So then after the 2008 financial crisis, a lot of Americans wind up leaving the banks. What was happening at that point?
Well, there are a few things that are happening. I mean, one is that people really lost, they lost a lot of money. You know, they saw their wealth decline a great deal. Many people lost their jobs, or I just recently interviewed a woman in California who was put on furlough because the state itself was doing poorly. She was a public sector employee. Credit also was retracted. So, you know, a lot of people had gotten used to charging everything on credit cards and having a lot of credit available to them through more traditional channels, not payday lenders. And suddenly that credit got ratcheted back. So people were able to, credit card companies were saying, well, you no longer have a $5,000 limit, you have a $2,000 limit. And people had no time to really adjust to that. And so they ended up having to look for credit in other places. So the crisis was a huge blow, and a particular blow to younger families and to people of color. Blacks and Latinos lost a lot more of their wealth than white families.
You tell a pretty poignant story early in this book about a dad who took his daughter to open up a savings account. You know, he wanted to teach her about the value of saving and the glories of compound interest, but it didn't work out very well. What happened?
Yeah, and it was so interesting when I got that email from someone who'd read my work, because it reminded me of my own childhood going to the bank and watching my money grow bit by bit. Yeah, going with my parents. So this guy, you know, trying to, I think, recreate his childhood experience, brought his daughter to the bank with $50. And the idea was that they would go every month and put some money in, and that he would teach her that lesson of savings. Everyone says savings is a habit you have to cultivate, and that they would watch the money grow bit by bit. They went back the next month, and instead of $50 in her account, there were $45 because she didn't have the right, she didn't have the minimum monthly balance.
And fees got her, yeah.
And fees got her, right. So we've seen that fee income really change things for people. And you know, so this guy actually closed that account and closed his own account. He was so mad at the bank.
So what's the trend line here, Lisa? Are the number of checking and savings accounts dropping across the country?
We have seen small drops in that, in checking and savings accounts. You know, I think many people are, the people who do remain banked are not necessarily happy with their banks, but they don't necessarily
understand. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. People don't know that they do have other options. And so there are a couple of things. One is there are banks that do a better job. You have to do a lot of research to figure it out, though. I actually put a button on my website, lisaservon.com, that says how to leave your bank, that provides some good tips for people who are really frustrated. Some of the smaller, more community-oriented banks, military banks, if you have a connection to the military, I bank with USAA, for example, has great customer service, and credit unions, which a lot of people don't really understand are provide all the same financial services as banks do. They're member organizations. They're cooperatives. So when you join, you're not just someone who the business is trying to make money off of. You own a piece of that co-op, the cooperative. And on average, people spend a lot less money on fees per year at a credit union than at a bank.
Think that so many people having left banks would seem to be a troubling sign for the banking industry, but you say they don't care.
You know, they're not making as much money. Banks have almost dual business models when it comes to serving people. They have the people who put lots and lots of money there, who get great benefits of free checking and savings and free, you know, replacement ATM cards and all sorts of benefits from the bank, because the bank can use that money to invest. And then there are people who are at the lower level who end up generating the money that they do make for banks comes in the form of fees. Mm-hmm. I think people in the middle, for the most part, probably people like me, you know, we don't make that much of a difference to banks' bottom line. And it is connected to banks' growth and their ability to do more. So if you can create these very sophisticated instruments, like the kinds of instruments, for example, that led to the financial crisis, if you can do business internationally, Citibank does a lot of business internationally, then you're not as reliant on customers for making a profit. Banks were back in that more boring time.
I wanted to go back to your experience working as a teller and as a payday lender to do background for this book. You also learned something else, that there's what you call a chronic financial insecurity that's growing among the middle class. In fact, in the Bronx, you found an unholy number of people who had no money left over after paying their bills each month. What else did you see out there?
Really, a lot of interesting things. I saw that many of my customers at the check cashier did have bank accounts, but preferred the check cashier for certain kinds of things. They can actually do a lot of things there that they couldn't do at their bank. They could pay their bills. They could buy a Metro card and a stamp. if they wanted to get around. MetroCard is what we use on the New York City subway. They appreciated the transparency. So even though they were paying fees for things that you would not necessarily have to pay a fee for directly at a bank, they appreciated that they knew exactly what they were getting.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple things I learned. One is that people will pay to get their money as soon as they can get it. So if you have a paper check and you deposit that into a bank, even where you have an account, it's not going to clear for 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
So
well,
if you're working, yeah.
Well, was it tough for you to get those jobs?
Well, no. Yes and no, I guess. I mean, I obviously had to find people who would be willing to have a pesky professor move in and see everything that was going on. The guy who hired me in the South Bronx, Joe Coleman, is a very interesting and innovative thinker, and he was really curious about what I would find. So, and then he, having had that experience, was helpful in getting me to make a connection with a payday lender. But I think I was surprised overall at how open the people in this industry were. I think given how the bad reputation they have, I thought they would behave as though they had something to hide, and that was not the experience I had.
What did the places look like where you worked?
You know, it's striking. One of the things I talk about in the book is transparency. And I really contrasted the places I worked with walking into a bank. You know, you walk into an average bank branch and it's a pretty sterile, plain vanilla mm-hmm. environment. And what's really striking to me is that there's no signage in a bank about what you can get there. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's not like walking into a grocery store where you can see all these products. There's not even signage really that says, here are the three types of checking accounts we offer. You kind of have to know what you're doing. Whereas you walk into a check casher or a payday lender and it almost looks like a fast food restaurant. There is a series of signs that span the top of the teller windows that let you know exactly what they have on offer and what it costs for each thing. And I think that really reassures people. So it's not so tricky. It's transparent. And that's one of the things people really value.
Sometimes you got tipped.
I did get tipped, yeah, which kind of speaks to that third thing that I mentioned, which is service.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I noticed almost immediately when I worked at both of these places was how well the tellers knew the customers. They knew every person by name. They knew a little bit about maybe their family or where they worked so they could engage in a conversation. And the customers really appreciated that relationship, and they appreciated the service that they got. They sometimes tipped us at Right Check in the South Bronx. There were a couple customers who knew how we took our coffee and would bring us coffee in the morning. The teller who trained me was very pregnant when I came on board and had her baby during the time I worked there, and people would drop off baby gifts. So there were these kind of tangible pieces of evidence that people thought, yeah, I'm getting served well here. I trust these people, and I value that. So even though I don't have a lot of money, I'm going to give you a couple bucks because you just did right by me.
Lisa Servon is my guest. Her book, The Unbanking of America. Your goal is no less than to launch a movement that would lead to an overhaul of the consumer financial services industry. What do you want to see happen here as you go forward?
I think that we really need to change the conversation for one thing. We've been kind of talking about people in categories of whether or not they have a bank account and judging them by that. I think what we really need to start talking about is financial health, whether people have the tools necessary to become financially healthy, and financial justice, to really understand whether all people are being treated equally well by the financial services system. I think the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is the newest federal regulatory agency, is doing a really good job of holding financial services providers accountable for the kind of products and services that they provide. But I think we need to look more broadly than bank. We both have to hold banks accountable, hold their feet to the fire, and also spur innovation, look for other kinds of products, and really, really think about what we need to do in order to enable all Americans to be financially healthy. Right now, we do not have that situation.
When you say hold banks' feet to the fire, are you suggesting that people should be more upfront when they go into their banks and say, hey, I didn't like this fee. I didn't like the way you handled this situation.
Absolutely. And I think anybody who's called customer service at their bank, or most people, I don't want to, there are better banks and worse banks. You don't always end up having a great experience doing that either. The CFPB, which I just mentioned, has a consumer complaint portal where you can actually lodge those complaints, and the CFPB follows up with the banks or other consumer financial services providers to make sure they respond. You can also move your money. That's probably one of the most powerful things people can do. That people think they don't have choices, but they actually do.
Ultimately, you say, Lisa, that we're all underbanked. And you mean what by that? And why is everybody underbanked?
Well, when I walk around, so many people tell me, as you did right away, that they're not happy with their bank. And I think, banking is a relationship like any other relationship, and we deserve good service. We deserve to be able to trust banks and not think they're going to do things like Wells Fargo recently did, opening up sham accounts in people's names without their permission or charging us for services we never received. So we need to either demand the right kind of treatment from those organizations that we're in relationship with, or we need to end the relationship.
Well, Lisa Surabhan is a professor of city planning at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's the author of The Unbanking of America. Lisa, you were great. Thanks very much for the good conversation.
Thank you so much. It's been a
You
pleasure.
bet. You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcurupto-date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and KCUR is also on Facebook. On Monday's program, psychologist Wes Crenshaw is back to discuss how your teen learns from today's media. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Steven Seigman, Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatakoro, the super intern who leads our staff today after a great run here this spring. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.